From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, for 3 years, tenant advocates and the city of Boston tried to change rental laws. They failed.
I mean, there's clearly a hidden agenda. People who are more savvy see it for the, you know, quote-unquote, nose in the tent, which is how rent control began in the 60s.
We'll have a special report on the quiet death of a big idea.
So in the 60s, which side would you have been on when we were debating the Fair Housing Act? The Jim Brooks Stabilization Act is on that side of history.
Also today, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul on his experience in Putin's Russia and the current state of relations between Washington and Moscow.
The disarray inside the United States, that's a giant victory for Vladimir Putin.
Plus,
obviously LeBron was incredible in the first half.
But the Celtics were better in the second. We'll talk about the Celts' lead in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this show, we love what we like to call keyhole stories. They're little events that at first glance might not seem like anything special. But if you peer through them, the event reveals a vast and important set of issues that affect us all. Well, earlier this month, there was a keyhole moment on Beacon Hill. Superficially, it wasn't a big deal. State legislators had killed a bill. Put it to study is the euphemism, and it happens often enough. But this bill comes with a story. And when legislators killed it, it elicited a big reaction from some advocates.
This is unconscionable that our elected officials refuse to act at such a crisis time in our city. We see this as a real betrayal of our trust.
That's Lisa Owens. She's executive director of City Life Vita Urbana, a Boston tenant advocacy group. And Owens is talking about the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act, which was Boston's plan to get a handle on what some housing advocates call an eviction crisis. Well, the Jim Brooks Act was the last gasp in an effort that spanned almost 3 years. And because it has to do with housing, it touched every city neighborhood, cut across racial and socioeconomic lines, and laid bare just how hard it is to find workable compromises in Boston's housing crunch. Radio Boston producer and reporter Jamie Bologna and I have been following every step of this story for the past 3 years. And Jamie's here now. Hello.
Hi, Meghna. Listeners, we're about to walk you through that journey. It starts in the fall of 2015. This is about rentals and about the rapidly rising rents that come along with a healthy, booming city economy. You know, we went to East Boston in 2015.
Right. That was one of those neighborhoods, is one of those neighborhoods where rents are rising so fast that tenant advocates claimed they were seeing a, quote, displacement crisis. Here's what Matt Nickel, an attorney at Greater Boston Legal Services, said walking with us in East Boston in December of 2015.
It's displacement on a massive scale. Tenants are more and more seeing this as, you know, a threat to their very livelihood, their housing, their, you know, their life, because rents are rising so rapidly that no mortals can pay them.
And at the time, Meghna, advocates were calling East Boston one of the city's eviction hotspots. They said tenants were getting evicted en masse.
Right. So, Jamie, let's just take a second here to describe what that demand is. I mean, you're about to hear a bunch of numbers in this story because, in a way, numbers are the story. Now, here's some numbers to start with. According to the Greater Boston Housing Report Card, that's from Northeastern University, rents in Boston have risen more than 55% since 2009. Average market rent in what they call the inner Boston core is now $2,800 per month.
So by 2015, tenant advocates felt like things had reached a sort of critical mass. They felt like this could be a moment where the city of Boston might be able to push for the most sweeping set of rental reforms in a generation.
That last change a generation ago?
That was the end of rent control in 1994. But this time, tenant advocates wanted to push for tenant protections. They called it a just cause eviction ordinance. And Meghna, can you explain what that is?
Right. Well, in its simplest form, just cause basically means that it would become much harder for Boston landlords to use the state's no-fault eviction statute to evict a tenant. Instead, evictions could only happen under certain predetermined criteria, such as a failure to pay rent, damage to the property, the landlord needing the home for a relative, reasons like that.
And just cause evictions as an idea is not a new one. A version of it has been on the books in San Francisco since 1995, for example.
Yeah. So at the end of 2015, though, here in Boston, a proposed just cause eviction ordinance began quietly circulating around City Hall. And a few months later, in March of 2016, the proposal got its first hearing in Boston City Council. And Jamie, you were there.
I was, and I've really never seen anything like it. So much energy and excitement for a city council meeting.
We are now at capacity. We are going to move the rest of you to an overflow room.
And that meeting turned out hundreds of people in March of 2016. Advocates, tenants, landlords, developers, everyone was there. And testimony started in the afternoon. It ran late into the night as city councilors one by one had to excuse themselves to attend to family obligations. It was contentious and it was heated.
Oh, yeah.
I spoke to tenants like Lemmy Horton from Mattapan.
64 in Newark, they fought for housing. 65, Chicago with Martin Luther King, they fought for housing. Now we're here again in Boston fighting again for housing. How many times we got to fight this displacement?
Well, that's exactly why housing advocates were saying that they were pushing for this just cause eviction ordinance. And we should note here, the proposal contained a very ambitious idea, right, Jamie? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was their most ambitious idea of all. Advocates wanted to require non-binding mediation between landlords and tenants anytime a landlord wished to raise the rent by more than 5%.
And Meghna, that part of the proposal went absolutely nowhere. The city and advocates dropped it from the proposal before the meeting even started. But there was a deeper issue here, another problem that needed to be solved first. The city and advocates didn't even know how big this so-called eviction crisis was.
And that's because?
Back to the data. They just didn't have it. Here's what Sheila Dillon, she's chief of housing for the city of Boston, told city councilors that night.
We need better data for lots of reasons. One, so we can design policies and programs. And two, so we can track where this is happening the most, so we can put safeguards in place for them.
Well, however, we should note, though, that there are some data out there. And in fact, it's in Boston Housing Court, where about 5,000 eviction cases are processed every year.
Sure, the city can comb through those court records and get the data from those 5,000 cases. But that can take a year, sometimes 2 years, to get through and get all that data. And Lisa Owens from City Life told the city council that night that not all evictions go to housing court, and that's why they need more data.
They get the eviction and they think that that eviction is a legal document. They don't know that they have the right to go to court to contest that. And they leave. They leave. That's what's happening here. And that's why we don't have the data.
And Meghna, I do want to note here that not everyone even agrees that there is a crisis. Rich Peretz, he's the president of the Small Property Owners Association. He thinks Boston has enough affordable housing already.
If you drive around Boston, all parts of Boston, from one end to the other, there are 52,000 units of incredibly high quality subsidized housing. How can there be a crisis with 126,000 people living in a subsidized unit who are income qualified? Like, they need it. They prove they need it. And they're getting it.
The city just disagrees on this point. They say they're working to build more affordable housing. But I do want to get back to that city council meeting, because the just cause eviction proposal would have required landlords to notify the city anytime they served a notice to quit to a tenant. And here's another really big sticking point. That data would also have been available to housing advocates and support groups. And I mean, that worried a lot of people.
Landlords, especially landlords large and small. And Jamie, you talk to landlords and developers, but especially those small landlords, because I just want to say it's easy in a story like this to paint huge, faceless corporate real estate companies as dominant forces in the Boston housing market. And they do indeed drive a lot of the market. But what was so interesting to us about this rental reform story is that some of the most passionate people we heard from over the years were hardworking small landlords, you know, Bostonians who own just a couple of units.
Exactly. People like Joshua Acevedo. He's an East Boston landlord who told me he's the owner occupant of 6 units.
I have my mother-in-law that lives with us, and I might have to soon be taking care of a sister-in-law or another relative. Why should that be within my right after a rental contract ends for me to take 2 properties to give to my own family? At the end of the day, my name is on the deed. I'm the sole one responsible if somebody gets injured on my property, so why should I not have a right to say who lives in that property if it's not within a defined contract?
Well, again, this is March 2016 at the City Council, and the just cause eviction idea, it just hit a huge obstacle. It was too controversial, and the City Council did not vote on it.
Right. And instead, Sheila Dillon's office and advocates went back to the drawing board. They negotiated and they reworked.
Okay, so Jamie, we're basically a year into this story now.
Right.
We're at November 2016. And here we come to the point where Mayor Marty Walsh's administration released the first draft of the city's master planning document, the Imagine 2030 report. It was really the first such plan in, I don't know, generations.
Yeah, and that first draft, and in future versions as well, the city had huge sections on housing. They said they were going to focus on building 50,000 more units and keeping the city growing and affordable.
And the Walsh administration, interestingly, adopted the language of tenant advocates. The report also called for the city to reduce displacement and, quote, develop and deploy a robust anti-displacement policy package. So we're marching through time here, but we're now at January 2017 in this story. Remember, we started back in 2015. And this anti-displacement policy package that we're talking about, in January of 2017, in his State of the City address, Mayor Marty Walsh announced five bills aimed at addressing housing issues in the city.
We are helping people stay in their homes and their neighborhoods. We created an Office of Housing Stability, and we will file five bills at the State House protecting residents from displacement.
And Sheila Dillon, chief of housing for the city, explained the package to us in more detail.
We had a right to counsel bill that would require tenants going into housing court to have counsel. We had a modest tax credit for owners that were renting to tenants at below market rate rents. We had a right to purchase from tenants if their buildings were foreclosed upon. And we had the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act. All really thoughtful pieces of legislation.
So that last one, right, Jamie, the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act, that one was the Walsh administration's official follow-up to the Just Cause eviction ordinance that had totally failed in City Council in March the year before.
Right. And they crafted something they thought would satisfy advocates and be at least palatable to landlords. It still had the data collection piece in it. Landlords would have still needed to report lease non-renewals and evictions to the city.
Right. So because the city still wanted to, as you said, just said, collect the eviction data to see who was getting evicted when and where in the city of Boston. Now this version of the Jim Brooks Act also still held on to another key provision.
If landlords wanted to evict, they could only do so under certain enumerated reasons.
And that was a problem for landlord groups pretty much from the moment the mayor first introduced the Jim Brooks Act. Here's what Greg Vassell, he's CEO of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, here's what he told us.
So it makes it harder for landlords to get rid of situations where there's guns, prostitution, illegal drug activity, because you have to prove that the leaseholder, that person themselves, are the ones that are causing the activity and not the others.
Oh, I see, because it specifies that it's the tenant who has had to use the unit for illegal purposes.
And the landlord is the person responsible for proving that.
And Lydia Edwards, she was then the head of the Office of Housing Stability, she pushed back on this point. She told you that the vast majority of evictions in Boston come when tenants don't pay rent, and that was the first reason provided for legal eviction in that Just Cause eviction proposal.
And I just want to also note, many people get the notice to quit,
and they just
leave,
do it.
And they
right.
give up, and they do not know their rights. And that's why this law is so important, to make sure that they understand what they're giving up, why they're giving it up, and if they do have any rights, they should know about them.
I mean, you can still hear the passion on all sides around this issue. So this brings us to March 2017, and this version, the mayor's version of the Jim Brooks Act, comes before the city council.
And again, massive turnout at City Hall. If you go online and watch the video on the city's website, you'll see that the morning session dragged well into the afternoon, 6 hours of questioning and testimony. And city councilors at that meeting heard from large landlords like Sarah Mathewson. She's senior vice president at Avalon Bay.
We understand and fully appreciate that it's not intended to be rent control. But we have had several well-educated, experienced, well-read attorneys see there is a window. And we're concerned about that opening and how that can impact the value of real estate over the long term. And over the long term, it could act as a deterrent to produce more housing.
So a common concern, again, that we heard over the years. But at that same meeting, though, city councilors also heard from tenants and advocates like Lydia Lowe. She's co-director of the Chinese Progressive Association.
Every day we are helping tenants who are fighting displacement from Chinatown. This is absolutely about keeping people in the city, and it is a racial justice issue, which is one piece of a broader stabilization agenda. This bill alone is not going to stop displacement, but it's an important piece.
And after that meeting, it took the city council another 8 months of tinkering and behind-the-scenes negotiations, and what they finally voted on had been slimmed down yet again.
Slimmed down is a very kind way of putting it. It had been really cut down because almost all the language about just cause evictions had actually been stripped out.
So basically all that was left was that evictions data collection piece. Here's Sheila Dillon again, Boston's chief of housing.
The information was also going to help the city track where we were seeing, you know, whole buildings being emptied out. It allowed us to reach out to the tenants, reach out to the owners to see if compromises and negotiations could be reached.
So in October 2017, this is the version of the Jim Brooks Act that finally passed the city council.
Okay, so that brings us to 2018, right, Jamie? Mm-hmm. Going into year number
3
of this rental reform odyssey. So the Jim Brooks Act is a home rule, or I should say was a home rule petition, and so it had to actually be approved by the Massachusetts state legislature before it could go into effect in Boston. Now, but before we actually get to what happened on Beacon Hill, I just want to take a step back here for a second, Jamie, and recap, because we've been covering a lot has happened so far.
Right. So we went from hearing about an eviction crisis from tenants and advocates in 2015 to advocates asking for mediation for big rent increases, proposing allowing evictions only under certain circumstances, and they wanted tenant advocates to have access to the city's eviction data.
Now, all of these ideas, all of them, faced significant opposition. I mean, landlords, big and small, and developers had a really powerful point that rental reforms like these could stymie Boston's housing market. So by the time the Jim Brooks Act reached Beacon Hill in January of 2018, those proposals had been totally snuffed out. Dealing with the displacement crisis as a whole had effectively been reduced down to just a data collection proposal.
And even that piece of it didn't survive. A little earlier this month, Senator William Brownsberger, he's chair of the legislature's Joint Committee on the Judiciary, he told us that they put the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act to study.
Put to study is sort of a euphemism for it's not going anywhere this year.
In other words, the Jim Brooks Act was officially dead. And in fact, so were most of the other proposals in Mayor Walsh's anti-displacement package, which all means that 3 years of ambitious ideas, negotiations, reality checks, and revisions, that had all been whittled down to nothing.
Nothing.
So tenant advocates, they're heartbroken and angry. Here's Lisa Owens of City Life.
This was a simple choice. Who do you stand with? Do you stand with the thousands of families that are facing displacement right now? Or do you stand with a real estate company that wants to make a few extra dollars at the expense of a family becoming homeless? That's really what this was about.
And Meghna, the landlord side doesn't see it this way. They saw this as an encroachment on their property rights because failure to comply with the data collection provisions of the Jim Brooks Act, that would have meant that an eviction or lease non-renewal would be dismissed and the tenant would be allowed to stay.
It was absolutely rent control.
This is Rich Peretz again, president of the Small Property Owners Association.
It talked about forced renewals. The property owner had to renew all leases. They kind of twisted that for propaganda purposes to the word eviction. Or a property owner choosing not to renew a lease is not an eviction.
And Sheila Dillon, the city's housing chief, she disagrees with that point. She says under the bill, landlords had the option to not renew leases. They just had to notify the city of their intentions.
These were really small, fairly incremental requirements that we thought most landlords could live with.
Most landlords could live with. That's what Sheila Dillon thought. Obviously, she was wrong because, I mean, Rich Peretz just does not see it that way.
I mean, there's clearly a hidden agenda. People who are more savvy see it for the, you know, quote-unquote, nose in the tent to be expanded to work its way back to forced lease renewal and reasonable rent, which is how rent control began in the 60s. It was very softy, very reasonable, and ratcheted up.
Now, Jamie, I mean, let's stop and think about this for a second,
okay.
Because it's one of the very few aspects of this story over the years that we've been covering it where we found any agreement at all, right?
Yeah.
I mean, many people we spoke with over the past 3 years did say that Boston's housing crunch today feels as big as the housing challenges of the 1960s. I mean, just listen to how tenant advocate Lisa Owens talks about it.
This is the modern day sort of fair housing fight that we're in. In the 60s, where would you have been? Which side would you have been on when we were debating the Fair Housing Act? The Jim Brooks Stabilization Act is on that side of history. And if you are listening to the interests of the real estate lobby, you're on the wrong side.
And Owens and other activists told us that tenant groups aren't giving up. In fact, they're doubling down and they're going to push for even stronger tenant protections.
That's going to be a huge uphill battle, if the past 3 years are any indication.
And as for the city, Mayor Walsh's housing chief Sheila Dillon didn't give us any specifics on what they might do next, other than the fact that they'll continue to push for the construction of new housing and for the protection of tenants.
These are families. These are our elders. These are low-income residents. We have to keep fighting the good fight.
Okay, but here's the thing, Jamie. Is it a good fight? Is it the right fight for the city right now?
Right, and if the past 3 years have shown Boston anything, it's that ultimately building more and better affordable housing can solve Boston's housing crunch. Regional housing plans will solve the problem. Putting aside protectionist localism and NIMBYism will solve the problem. Funding major transportation expansion projects will also solve the problem.
And lots of people we talked to agreed on all of these things. But honestly, the most perplexing aspect of this story to me, to you, to us, is that here we are, right, in the 21st century. This is Boston of the 21st century, and everybody knows that data is king. But, you know, even as Boston, like, just glitters with growth and possibility, it's the jewel of the state's information and ideas economy. When it comes to rental units, Boston lacks the granular data to describe the basic scope and scale of the challenge around rental housing.
Yeah, and in these 3 years, we heard it over and over, particularly from the city. If we only had the data. The city thinks data hold the answers.
Yeah, but again, the reason why we're talking about this story is that they couldn't even get basically a data collection bill passed on Beacon Hill. Which is interesting because, I mean, the numbers could potentially be a powerful accounting tool that might help Boston navigate its way forward and help it nurture the real estate boom, keep doing that, grow the economy without returning to restrictive rent control, and possibly even support tenants and property owners. But Jamie, after all this, I really do wonder, can the city do all of that at once?
I think that's a question that no one really has the answer to.
Well, Radio Boston producer and reporter Jamie Bologna, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, as we've been saying, we've been reporting the story for 3 years, and we've got a lot more details on the fate of the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act. We'd also love to know what you think, so head over to radioboston.org and let us know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Wednesday, and now we're joined in the studio for our weekly look at sports by Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, guess where I'm going to start?
I hope you're going to start with the Celtics.
107-94 over Cleveland last night, up 2-0 in the Eastern Conference Finals. What's not to love?
Well, it's a spectacular start, no question about it. And I thought that last night's game was especially fascinating because everybody who was talking about this series was saying, look out, LeBron James is going to come back big. This is what he does after his team gets blown out. He comes back and he has an absolutely magnificent game. And it looked as if that's exactly what he was going to do. He scored 21 points in the first quarter. I think he was taking something like 70% of his team's shots. I don't know exactly what it was.
But ends up like, with a triple-double.
Yeah, I mean, he had, statistically, he had a great game, you know, by the standard measure of points, rebounds, and assists. But it was not nearly the kind of game. He would have had to score 60 points because his cast of characters surrounding him was simply not up to the task that the Celtics presented them with. The Celtics currently keep coming in waves,
yeah.
And they have not one guy who scores 40 points. They have 60 points spread among four or five guys as they go along, and it simply has been an overwhelming presentation.
I'm hearing you say there's no I in team. There's no
I've been talking about this with several people after the first game and after the second game last night. What you love, I think, if you're a real basketball fan, is the way the Celtics are playing as a team. And it's not just that they're passing the ball around and everybody gets to score. It's also the way they play defense.
Yeah.
And it's reminiscent a little bit of the old Bill Russell days, where guys could really play aggressive defense because they knew Bill Russell was behind them. Now, there's no Bill Russell behind them at this point, but they know that they've got teammates who are going to help them out, who are going to cover for them and switch off. And when they were double-teaming LeBron James, particularly after the first quarter, the frustration was evident. And he was turning the ball over. He was missing shots badly. He was unable to find the open man that he should have been able to find and pass to, because that's what you do when you're getting double-teamed and triple-teamed. And they simply did it too well. He couldn't do it.
Well, but they had to, right? Because, I mean, what, 42 points, 10 rebounds, 12 assists.
Oh, yeah.
But let me just, I just want to play a little bit of tape here, Bill, because, I mean, here's how Celts head coach Brad Stevens talked about, you know, the fact that the team really held it together even after James's, like, incredible first half.
I thought our guys did a really good job of weathering the initial storm. Obviously, LeBron was incredible in the first half. It's all about responding. They're going to make their runs. They're going to have their moments. The most encouraging thing to me was that we weathered that storm. It's easy to kind of fall apart there.
Composure, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that he says first half, because that's I hate to contradict somebody who's doing such a magnificent job, but it wasn't quite the first half, because late in the second quarter, LeBron James got clocked, took a shoulder to the head, an inadvertent foul. And he was not the same player after that. Mm-hmm. His stats went way down. And they said he left the game briefly with what they said was a strained neck. But if you watched the replay, it looked very much like what happens to football players so often, which is his neck was jerked around. You could almost envision his brain bouncing around inside his skull. And I have to think that that was a very much a discombobulating, injury. And because he came back, it's not that they lost him for the rest of the game, but he was not the player that he had been before that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's obviously no doubt that LeBron James is a phenomenal player. But to get back to your point about the Celtics, now the Celts have themselves up. 2-0 in the Eastern Conference Finals. They're headed off to Cleveland for the next game. But this is a really, I think, a surprisingly strong start.
Yeah, it's a very strong start. It's a great start. And it sets up, as these series often do. This is why people who don't pay attention to the NBA through the regular season suddenly get very interested when it's time for the playoffs. Because this is potentially, it's a best, 4-7 series. Could go 6 games, could go 7 games. Who knows? And the plot twists,
which you love.
The possibilities are infinite. You're a fan in Cleveland. How do you feel when your team, led by the great LeBron James, comes home down 2-0? Do you feel like, I'm not even going to the game, these bums, they can't even go 1-1 in Boston?
Cleveland is used to being underestimated.
Or, well, that's true, but they've had some champions now.
Yeah.
They have had some champions now. Or do you go saying, I'm a Cleveland Cavaliers fan, I'm going to be there, I'm going to be wearing my uniform,
jersey. They're going to be there, there's no question.
Well, it's exciting, though. It's fun. And what happens if Cleveland gets off to a poor start in Game 3? Does the crowd turn against them, and in which case home court advantage suddenly goes up in smoke? Or do they support them? And what if they get off to a great start? What if they're up 13-3 early?
Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Littlefield is literally, well, not literally.
It's going to be great
fun.
He
is on the edge of his seat.
This is why people pay attention to the postseason in the NBA, and I think it's great.
Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. It airs every Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And he joins us on Wednesdays here at Radio Boston. Okay, I should have been excited beforehand about these
well,
Eastern Conference
excited.
Finals,
now,
but
now
you really
have to wait
got
till
me
Saturday.
Going. It's time to calm down so we can rev back up. Bill, thanks as always.
A pleasure. Thank you, Magna.
And I want to put this note out to everybody about something special that Radio Boston has going on tomorrow. We're going to have a special debate between the two Democratic candidates running for governor. That's Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey. We're partnering with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston for this debate. You can listen to that right here on Radio Boston. But there's a lot more information about the debate and attending live. Go to WBUR.org/events. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If President Donald Trump's meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un goes ahead, and as of today, that's a big if, since North Korea has threatened to pull out of that meeting. But if it happens, what kind of relationship might the two men have? And what effect would that have on the relations between their two nations? Now, there are examples in very recent history about how things can get personal and even ugly when we're talking about representatives. Top-level representatives of major global powers. I mean, consider what happened to Michael McFaul. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. And in 2012, as Vladimir Putin was running for election in Russia, McFaul found himself the victim of a viral video that accused him of being a pedophile. And to this day, searches for McFaul's name and the word pedophile turn up millions of hits on Russian search engines. And it's just one of the stories that McFaul tells in his new political memoir. It's called From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. And Michael McFaul joins us now. Ambassador, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
In just a couple of minutes, we're going to bring in Admiral James Stavridis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School
That's always
of
wise.
Law and Diplomacy and also
That's
former Supreme
man, yes.
Yeah, Allied Commander of NATO. And NATO yep. plays a big role in the story that you tell here in the book. But Ambassador, I just wanted to start off with hearing a little bit more about this story, about this viral video. And I bring it up because I think it's very demonstrative of the things that Vladimir Putin was capable of doing even as far back as 2012. But first of all, was it Putin behind that video?
Well, we have no way of knowing. And that's the way the Putin regime works. They always use cutouts. It's never directly from the Kremlin. Same way in 2016, by the way, the things that they've done. So I don't assume that it was him. But was there a broad campaign against me personally, against President Obama himself, where they described him as being a supporter of ISIS during the same time? That was crystal clear. And those television stations, primary television, because that's where Russians get their media from, they are all controlled by the Kremlin. And it was designed for a purpose. It wasn't just something personal about me. It was designed for a purpose because at that time, there were big demonstrations against Putin and his regime. And so they needed to mobilize their base against the West. They pulled out a kind of old Cold War narrative that the West was out to get them. And they blamed us, America, Obama, and me, for supporting, allegedly, we weren't, but for supporting the Democratic opposition rallying against Putin.
So this is 2012. Obviously, 2016 and Russian meddling in the U.S. election is what immediately comes to mind.
It should.
But how did the Obama administration, how did you as ambassador respond in 2012? I mean, to this viral video?
Well, it's hard. And I'm glad we're talking about it because now we're talking about fake news and disinformation. And many Americans have just become aware of this phenomenon. But several years ago, of course, we were experiencing it directly. And it's difficult. What do? You get on Twitter and say, I'm not a pedophile? That doesn't work too well. Then some people start arguing with you. You know, my wife didn't even want me to put this story in the book, just so you know, because she thinks once you say that, suddenly people are thinking in different ways about you. And that's how disinformation works. And remember, Putin's not trying to win the argument about anything. He's just trying to make a mess about the truth and falsehoods. And that's how disinformation works. And it worked, I think, tragically, successfully against our administration.
Well, so I'm curious what you think about this, because I imagine that critics of the Obama administration would say that, first of all, in 2016, the administration's response to what they knew at the time about Russian meddling wasn't robust enough.
Yes.
sounds like, I mean, if you say it was hard and you didn't really know what to do in 2012, that it also wasn't robust enough. I mean, was this basically, were there multiple times, before 2016 where the United States failed to push back against Vladimir Putin on these things?
Yes, I think there was.
But why?
Well, a couple of reasons. And remember, I'd left the government in 2014, but all my friends are still at the White House through 2016. And I would say a couple of things. One, this was new in American electoral politics. These were instruments of power that we'd seen in Russia and in countries near Russia, but we'd never seen it inside our own country. And both the stealing of information and then publishing it through WikiLeaks, that was something new. But also disinformation on our social media websites from Russia, we had never seen it. So that's number one. Number two, as they would tell you if they were here with you, my White House friends, they didn't want to weigh in because they were afraid of being accused of helping Secretary Clinton. That was a hard call. I want to make sure everybody understands for me that was a hard call. But I write about it in my book. I think they should have done more, particularly on this day, October 7th, 2016. They put out their statement. And I was at the White House before I went to Moscow. I know how you roll out a statement if you want to get it attention. You have it come out of the White House. You have a press conference about it.
But you don't know that an Access Hollywood tape is going to break.
Well, we didn't know that. That was a problem for them. But they rolled it slow. They didn't do that kind of thing. I think that was a mistake. And then don't forget, there are other actors involved here, Facebook, Twitter. They are also seeing this stuff for the first time, not fully understanding it and not fully understanding how to deal with it. And I deal with those companies quite a bit right now. I think they now see that it's no longer sufficient to say that we don't have an editorial policy. Algorithms are editorial policy. But back then it was brand new and they were just trying to figure it out in real time. Mm. And so they were slow to react.
So let me just go back to the 2012 moment again. And in fact, what I want to do is actually go back even further, because it's interesting to me that Putin used you in 2012. I mean, you were U.S. ambassador, so obviously very, very high profile in Russia, but as this poster boy for
literally, I was a poster boy, by the way. They made posters of me.
As the target for the grievances that he wanted to stoke in the electorate around his election.
Right.
But because it was just a couple of years before that, though, that, you know, there was the famous reset with U.S.-Russia relations. You're the architect of that reset. I mean, it was, what, 3 or 4 years
exactly.
In that how did things change so quickly?
Well, I am the architect of that, and that word is mine for better or for ill. And we had a fantastic run with the Russians. I'm glad you reminded your listeners. There was a period of cooperation with President Medvedev, not President Putin. And we got the START treaty done, bringing down by 30% the number of nuclear weapons allowed in the world. Sanctions on Iran that led to the Iran deal, which I think is a great deal. New supply routes to Afghanistan, Russian WTO. And back then, not just to ancient history, but 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the majority of Russians has a positive view of us and vice versa. It's a complicated story. That's why I wrote the book to explain it. But the punchline is two things happened. One, Putin comes back into power, and he has a different view about us. He sees us more in zero-sum terms, whereas Medvedev thought about win-win outcomes in cooperating with us. But then, two, back to when I arrived, demonstrations were against Putin, and he needed a new argument to win re-election. And so he made us the enemy again. And as you said, poster child, I just happened to arrive right in that mess. And one of his advisors said to me, you know, remember, I've been living in and out of that country for 30 years. I got a lot of friends in the government. And one of them, a Kremlin person, said, you know, Mike, don't take anything personal. We're just going to use you for this election, and then we're going to get back to normal. And I was like, pedophile? I'm not going to take that personal. I'm sorry. But it turned out we didn't get back to normal because he needed to keep that mobilization against us.
So I'm going to bring in Dean Stavridis here in just a second, but there's one piece of tape I want to play for you because, I mean, you were describing this good run that the U.S. had with the Russians. And there are even U.S.-based analysts who see it a little differently, right? I mean, just last week, you participated in a debate with Stephen Cohen.
Yes, I did.
Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies.
That's a pretty different view than
at
me.
At NYU and Princeton. And he basically said to you that during the Obama reset, the U.S. was asking Russia for significant concessions. But he says the U.S. didn't give up very much in return. And here's Cohen.
This was called selective cooperation. And best I understand this expression, Professor McFaul has used it, so has Mrs. Clinton and others. Selective cooperation means we get, they give, and we pretend it's diplomatic cooperation.
What do you say?
Well, two things. Back then, it was not selective cooperation. That comes when Putin comes in. We were cooperating on everything. We were cooperating on airspace and civil society. We even had, we had 22 working groups with the Russians back at the height of the reset. But number two, with all my respect for Professor Cohen's academic work, diplomacy is not about concessions. Nobody ever does anybody any favors in international diplomacy, especially not with the Russians. And so the idea that we're going to give them concessions and they're going to give us, it doesn't work that way. It has to be where both sides think that they're better off to sign this deal. Medvedev didn't sign the START Treaty as a concession to America. He signed it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest. He didn't sign up for sanctions on Iran as a gift to his buddy Barak. He did it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest. And when Putin comes in, he has a different definition
of what
Russian national interests are.
Okay. This is,
and let me tell you, I worked at the White House. You don't come in and get some blue book off the table that says, here is America's interests. To follow this. Individuals matter and individuals define it in different ways.
Okay. Absolutely fascinating. It's the perfect entree to James Stavridis. Yeah. He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and also former Supreme Allied Commander for NATO in Europe. Dean Stavridis, it's always great to have you. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Magna. How are you? And my best to Ambassador McFaul, who's a very close friend. Hi, Mike.
Good to have you here, Jim.
So we're trying to sort of cover a lot of complex ground here, James Stavridis, but I want to get your take on something that Michael McFaul just said, that Vladimir Putin defines what is in Russia's national interest different than his predecessors or differently. And that brings, to my mind, that brings NATO into the picture here, right? Because you know, NATO is on Russia's doorstep. And so is it understandable, perhaps even forgivable, for Vladimir Putin to take a much more bellicose nationalistic posture when he sees the Western alliance just across his borders?
I think it's understandable, but not forgivable. So the way I would start is by saying, to understand Russia, you just have to understand the history and culture and the way that strong masculine figures over time dominate that landscape. You kind of roll the cosmic dice. Sometimes it works out. You get Peter the Great. The next time you get Ivan the Terrible. Maybe you get a Stalin, but then you get a Gorbachev. You get a Medvedev, as Mike points out, and you have some trade space. But then those dice, those cosmic dice, have landed on Vladimir Putin. So to understand Russia, I think from this moment forward, throughout the lifespan of Vladimir Putin, we have to understand Putin, which brings us to the answer to your question. And it is his background as a KGB agent. He grew up, was weaned on the poisonous NATO. And as he did see NATO countries join, who had formerly been under the Soviet Union, that was very unappealing to him. And I hasten to say, by the way, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, hey, no NATO tanks rolled into those countries forcing them to join NATO. They begged to join NATO. Why? Because they'd spent decades under the boot of the Soviet Union. So Putin sees that. He's bitter. He believes that the collapse of the Soviet Union, quote, was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, end quote. And all that anger, I think, is central to his worldview. So his objective, frankly, is to break the United States away from NATO. And that's what a lot of the fake news, the cyber, is intended to do. And it's going pretty well so far from his perspective.
Michael McFaul, jump in here.
I agree, and let's start calling him Admiral Stavridis because he really earned that title. I didn't earn my title ambassador. You know, professor I earned, ambassador I was for a while. That's a hard title to get, especially that long one he had at NATO too. Pretty cool, right?
Supreme Allied Commander.
I would just add a couple of things. One, countries get to choose who their allies are. Russia doesn't get a veto to that. Number two, NATO is a defensive alliance. You know, I like to say when I put an alarm up in my house, that's not a threat to my neighbor unless my neighbor plans to break in. And that's what NATO is. But number three, we had got this at a different place at the height
can
of the
can I just, I'm here, I'm so sorry for, but my job is to play the foil to both of you. And your analogy of the alarm or the alarm system on the house is an interesting one because doesn't Vladimir Putin, he doesn't see an alarm on your house. He sees guns on the fence to separating his property from yours.
That's what he sees. And so do the Estonians on the other side of that fence. Yeah. And when you look at the balance of conventional weapons, I think a lot of Americans haven't been paying attention to this. It is moving in a negative direction for us where Putin has invested a lot on both more weapons, more soldiers, and more advanced weapons. So it's on both sides. But I want to bring in the leaders thing again because the tease that you put at the beginning I think is really important. I was at the NATO summit in Lisbon, 2010. I was there with President Obama. We met with President Medvedev. We had a great conversation with him there in the context of Russia-NATO Council. The entire conversation was about cooperation. It was about missile defense cooperation. And don't believe me, listeners, go Google Medvedev's speech at the NATO summit. And what you're going to hear there is not that we're threatened by NATO, but we've turned the page in a new era because it was parked. I was at every meeting with Medvedev and Putin for 5 years. And on every phone call, NATO expansion was not an issue. And I think what happens, by the way, our critics, our conservative critics, yelled about that we weren't doing enough on that. And what happens is once you have the end of the reset, the conflict over Ukraine, then Putin goes back and pulls from history these things to remind us, this was a problem from before. Wasn't a problem during the reset.
James DeVries, let me turn back to you. And I just we've just got a couple minutes left, and we always try to pack far too much into too short a period of time. But I want to ask you about sort of where we stand now, again, regarding Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, because I think arguably Trump's comments about Putin during the campaign and even during the first months of his presidency aside, you could say his administration may have been tougher thus far on Russia than the Obama administration was, right? Like they've added sanctions, they've sent arms to the Ukraine. I mean, when you look at it at that level, how would you describe, you know, U.S.-Russia relations right now?
I would describe them as worse than I have seen them throughout my career. And I think that the curious thing here is the lack of personal criticism that the president is willing to levy on Putin, despite the fact that Putin is obviously at the center of all of this. And as Ambassador McFaul just correctly pointed out, we actually got along reasonably well with Russia until Putin took over. And since then, these relations have just continued to crater. I think the administration has been right in increasing sanctions and right in responding diplomatically. I think we need to be stronger in our responses, Magna, in cyber. We still have cards to play there that across a variety of cyber options that I think are worth doing. Bottom line, what we should be doing is confronting Russia where we must on Ukraine, their support for a war criminal, Assad, in Syria, on cyber and intrusion in our elections. But we should cooperate where we can. We can have a kind of a blended approach. I think that's the best we're going to do.
James DeVries, let me just
under Vladimir Putin.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but since you mentioned cyber, I just have to remind people that just this week, the White House eliminated a top cyber advisor position.
Which is very foolish, a very ridiculous, foolish proposition. We have a cabinet that is perfectly constructed for the 19th century. We have a Secretary of Agriculture, a Secretary of Interior who administers national parks, but we don't have a cabinet-level voice on cyber, and now we've taken it off the NSC staff. Big mistake.
Wow. Well, James DeVries is the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's also former Supreme Allied Commander for NATO in Europe. Admiral DeVries, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna. Thanks to Mike McFaul, too. I'll see you in Montana this summer.
All right.
Montana native.
All right. We'll see you there.
My invitation must have been lost in the mail.
You're always welcome.
Ambassador McFaul, last question. We've just got 30 seconds here. I mean, you tell a very detailed story in the book, and obviously we're only scratching the surface here.
That's why people need to buy the book.
But when you say Cold War to hot peace, it's the hot word that concerns me. Like, do you share the same alarm that James Stavridis just shared with us?
Yeah, I use that phrase on purpose to echo elements of the Cold War, because there are things that are new, but it's not Cold War 2.0, because some things are different. Cyber is new. That's a totally new world that we did not encounter in the Cold War. Annexation. We thought annexation was done. In the Cold War, there was not annexation. Now we're back to that. And in particular, Putin is willing to use his power in a much more aggressive way than the last Cold War leaders. That makes it a very dangerous world.
Well, Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador to Russia between 2012 to 2014. His new book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia, and he'll be talking about it tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7. Ambassador McFaul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.